Okay, most climate scientists will tell you they are confident that humans are causing global warming. But the general public is not so sure. In one poll last year, only about 50% of people agreed humans were contributing. The other half disagreed, were not sure, or did not believe the Earth was warming in the first place, which brings us to the global warming skeptic we will meet this morning. Her name is Kristen Burns. She lives in Portland, Maine, and she is one of several people we're profiling as we conclude our series, Climate Connections with National Geographic. NPR's David Kestenbaum paid her a visit.
If you're a scientist trying to convince people they are making the world warmer, Kristen Burns is your worst nightmare. She's articulate, intelligent, she has a webpage, and one day, her people will be running the world. Her people, meaning 16-year-olds. That's her age.
I don't really remember how old I was when I started getting into the global warming, and I had a sense that it wasn't just us, because in middle school, I remember everyone was like, global warming, the world's going to end, stuff like that. So I never really believed in it.
Kristen Burns is wearing green furry slippers. She has a dog that barks at first, then licks, and a snake named Rex, who recently ate a mouse. She's no slouch academically. Her stepfather, Mike Carson, proudly shows off her grades.
97, 97, 98, 95, 89, 99. Hey, wait a minute. Geometry? It went down to 99. Oh, my goodness.
Quarter's not done.
Oh, you're grounded. You're grounded for a week.
Some scientists may cringe to hear this story, but Kristen has a quality you want in a scientist. She is skeptical. Someone makes a claim, she wants to see the data. So about a year ago, when she was 15, she started to look at the scientific evidence. When she got confused, she consulted her stay-at-home stepdad, Mike. Soon, they had printed out a mound of technical documents from the internet. Kristen was convinced by the skeptics, and she began to write, summarizing their arguments, adding her own touches. Yes, she says, the Earth is warming, but it's part of the natural climate cycle. The documents and papers filled a cardboard crate that once held green peppers, which all surprised her mom, Tammy Burns.
I was like, wow, alrighty.
Now, the story might stop here, a homegrown science project, except that, Kristen says, they decided to post it on the web.
I felt it was important to inform other people that this isn't completely true. Yeah, like a public service to let people know.
Mike set up the site. Tammy typed.
I was the faster typer, and so...
How much typing did you do?
Quite a bit.
The result was a website called Ponder the Maunder. Kristen admits the title is a little obscure. It's a reference to what's known as the Maunder Minimum, a low period in solar activity in the 1600s. Her webpage includes charts of El Nino indices, isotope measurements, and ice cores. Her tone is measured in some places, firm in others. Quote, I will start this section with a very important point. CO2 in the atmosphere does not reflect radiation back to the Earth, as some have tried to state. Skeptics loved the website. A 15-year-old attacking the mainstream scientific view.
Somebody had posted it on one of the blogs, and from there it took off. It took off like wildfire. But that was nothing compared to when her Al Gore critique went up.
Kristen had no fear. She took on Al Gore, Nobel laureate, Academy Award winner, former vice president. She went after Jim Hansen, one of NASA's top climate scientists. Mainstream scientists would argue many of the issues on her website are red herrings or have been put to rest. And Kristen did get emails from people challenging her science.
Yeah, there's a few who are like, you're wrong. I disagree with you on this, this, and this. And we'd come back and be like, actually, you're wrong on this, this, and this, and this is why. So,
what happened at the end of that?
A few of them just kind of gave up and figured they can't fight against a 15-year-old. So,
Mike says the website got 500,000 hits in a month. Emails poured in, mostly from people delighted that a young person was taking up their cause.
I got a letter in the mail for my birthday from a senator.
U.S. Senator James Inhofe, Republican from Oklahoma, famous for calling global warming a hoax.
Okay. Dear Kristen, thank you so much for your letter and email and for your kind words. I appreciate your help in the fight against global warming alarmism. You're a common sense young lady and an inspiration to me. I want you to keep up the good work. We are winning.
Kristen says when her determination sagged, her stepdad Mike encouraged her. Kristen, motivation, he would say. Mike himself is deeply skeptical of climate change.
Now, this is one of our little handy things here. What has happened here is we've taken a natural index, which is Southern Oscillation Index. It's a major indicator of the El Nino Southern Oscillation, and we've compared it to temperature.
And the truth is, for people who want to try to get down into the details, climate change science can get very hairy. There are oceans to consider which can absorb heat, water vapor, cloud cover to account for. Much of the evidence rests on detailed computer models. Scientists disagree on some of the details, and a handful of scientists do not think the case has been made. But the overwhelming consensus is that humans are causing global warming, and the consequences could be serious. When I visited Kristen, she had a friend over, Chrissy Flanders. They said climate change doesn't get much attention in school. And despite Kristen's online celebrity, she doesn't talk about climate change with her friends. During lunch, Chrissy and Kristen talked about food and friends and clothes. So it was sort of a surprise when Chrissy mentioned that she disagreed with Kristen on climate change.
No, I don't believe what you think.
Which you don't believe?
I think it's partly because of humans. I don't agree with you. Sorry.
That's okay. It's your opinion.
Okay, so why do you believe that humans are involved in climate change?
I don't know.
She just believes what everybody else is making her believe.
No, I don't really know. I guess maybe a little, but not all of it.
Not everybody's going to have time to look at the data, right? It's almost people are going to have to sort of decide, you know, if 300 scientists sign something, maybe for some people that's good enough for them.
Right. Like even the media, other scientists, they're making everybody believe that it is anthropogenic. And like Chrissy here, good example, she doesn't know why she believes it, but she believes it because it's what everybody else believes. And I know that's not what you think.
I don't really have an opinion. I don't really think about it.
Maybe you have an opinion. That's what you said.
It's probably fair to say that most people, even those who have strong opinions about global warming, could not make a strong scientific argument for why they believe what they believe. Most of us delegate, decide to believe someone we trust. We don't actively seek out the other side. We probably wouldn't know what to make of it or how to reconcile the two. Who has time or the expertise? Kristen is getting out of the climate change business. She thinks she'd like to become an architect. Maybe even build energy-efficient green buildings. She does not see herself as an environmentalist. She says that makes her think of hippies. David Kestenbaum, NPR News.
If you do have time to check the details, a United Nations scientific panel recently concluded that humans were very likely the cause behind present-day global warming, and you can read their report at npr.org. As nervous as you may be about the trouble in the U.S. economy, Kevin Phillips thinks you may not be nervous enough. Phillips is a former Republican strategist and former commentator on this program. In more recent years, he has sounded serious warnings about his country's politics, its economy, and its future. In a new book called Bad Money, Phillips argues there is a reason the credit crisis spreads through the whole economy. He says it's because the credit industry almost is the economy. How has Wall Street steered us as a country toward greater and greater debt of many different kinds?
You've had a massive upheaval in the United States in the last two decades in which financial services, the financial sector includes finance, insurance, and real estate, has dwarfed manufacturing, which has slipped way down and become the leading part of the economy in terms of share of gross domestic product. This sector ballooned. It increased hugely in size. One of its biggest products is actually debt and credit cards and debt obligations.
I want to make sure I understand what you're saying, because you're saying that this is an economy where we used to make steel, we used to make cars, we used to make television sets, any number of other things, and now you're arguing that the basic thing that we make the greatest share of money on is debt products and other financial services.
You've got an economy that runs basically on money being moved around. And we now have convenience fees on ATMs, all kinds of things like this. It doesn't make much anymore in terms of products. And as a result, we have to import huge amounts of manufactured goods and oil. And it costs just buckets and buckets of money. And we can't afford that. So we're an international debtor, too. It creates a special vulnerability. We have taken this sector, which is speculative, unstable, given to all kinds of practices that haven't been regulated much for the last 20 years, and put it in charge of the U.S. economy. That is not a smart idea.
What is it that makes you say that this period that you see in the United States where financial services are becoming more and more important as an economic engine, what is it that makes you say that that has been, in effect, a terminal stage or the late stage of other great nations and empires?
Well, if you look back at the leading world economic powers, the Dutch and then the British stopped doing what they were doing so well for so long, industry, maritime, commerce. And in their last decades, they became more and more dependent on finance, on providing services to the world, banking, maritime insurance, all of these sorts of things. And they thought that would work, that that was a new form of success, and that was the next stage of a great economy. It wasn't. It was a stage in which they were starting to lose what had been built up by the solid things, industry and physical commerce and agriculture and maritime industries. If we look at what happened to them, it's confirming the dangers of letting yourself get into this posture of thinking that you can provide services and finance to the world and that works. It never has.
Well, is there a reason that you choose to include this quote in your book, which goes even further back in history, for an analogy? If we are Rome, Wall Street's our Colosseum.
I thought that was a very good observation by a commentator on Market Watch. He used that slogan, and I think it's true in the sense that it's a global arena, Colosseum or not, but finance is where these things are being fought out. It's where we're losing these battles. The dollar is like a gladiator bleeding on the field of the Colosseum. Things that we used to produce that we don't produce anymore are just shooting up in their cost to us. We're importing inflation as the price of oil rises because people buy it as a substitute for investing in the dollar. The Colosseum is telling us huge trouble. But the Colosseum doesn't make it onto the evening news. The Colosseum just becomes little things about the Dow Jones Industrial Average, and it was a bad day on the market, and no sense that this is a nation's fate being adjudicated.
When you try to take the longer view, do you think it's already too late?
Well, it's not too late in one very important sense. These countries that have had these problems historically have gone through periods of 20, 30, 40 years when adjusting to their new lesser role has caused lots of problems. They've had to make major adjustments. They couldn't live nearly so high on the hog. The British even had food rationing for almost 10 years after World War II. But when you make the adjustments and you come out, you're strong again. And obviously Britain is prosperous now. So for the United States, the important thing is to think about the next stage after we go through the crisis and we build a better foundation and we stop thinking that we can be the policeman of the world, the banker of the world, the great advice giver of the world, et cetera, et cetera. That doesn't work. But there is a future for the United States, as there has been for all these others, when things change and the new framework is built.
Now, wait a minute. There was what was famously called the American century, a century dominated by the United States. Are you saying there's not going to be another, but we can at least hope for a pretty decent place in the Chinese century or whatever it's going to be?
Well, I would say that this century we're in now is not going to be the American century. If it was going to be the American century, we wouldn't be going hat in hand to the investment funds of Singapore, of Saudi Arabia, of China. Power is shifting to Asia. Wealth is shifting to Asia. Power is shifting away from the United States. We're fighting bad wars in bad places, and Asia's putting together the fulcrum of industry and finance and just about everything for, let's say, 20, 30, 40, 50 years out.
Kevin Phillips is a former Republican strategist, now the author of many books, the latest of which is called Bad Money. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Universal health care has been a topic of debate this political season. As the presidential candidates lay their policies out, we were curious about how other wealthy countries provide health care and if they hold lessons for the U.S. The journalist T.R. Reid has been looking into this, and his documentary about health systems around the world airs tonight on the PBS show Frontline. Yesterday, Reid took us to Japan. Today, Taiwan. Reid explains how Taiwan recently created its system of universal coverage.
At the end of the 20th century, Taiwan became a rich country almost overnight, but it still had a poor country's health care. About half the population had no coverage at all. So Taiwan set out to design a national health care system from scratch. Hong Jen Chung was one of the officials in charge back then. Walking through Taipei's imposing Chiang Kai-shek Memorial Park, he recalled how they did it.
Taiwan is a small island. We always look abroad internationally for ideas. Chinese saying, we say the track of the previous card is the teacher of the following card.
So if the other guy's ox cart has found a good route to universal health coverage, follow those tracks.
Follow those tracks. If they were trapped in the trouble, avoid that trap. Find a new track.
So they consulted experts from all over the world, like the Taiwanese-American health economist Sung Mei Chung.
In the end, the program that they finally set up in 1995 really is like a car that was made of different parts imported from overseas, but manufactured domestically.
They wanted a system that gave everybody equal access to health care, free choice of doctors with no waiting time, and a system that encouraged lots of competition among medical providers. To finance the scheme, they chose a national insurance system, a single government-run fund that forces everybody to join in and pay. The result, a system that works a lot like Canada's, or like the U.S. Medicare system, but with more benefits.
It has drug benefits, vision care, a traditional Chinese medicine, kidney dialysis, inpatient care, outpatient care, just about everything under the sun.
And to satisfy the patients in Taiwan, there's no gatekeeper who controls access to specialists and no waiting lines.
If I woke up in Taiwan some morning and my shoulder's really hurting, how long would it take me to see an orthopedic specialist?
We'll go now.
This morning I could see one?
Yeah.
I don't have to go to a GP and get a recommendation?
No, our people don't like the idea of gatekeepers. They want to decide by themselves.
By consolidating so much, one government plan that covers everybody, Taiwan achieves remarkable efficiency. Everybody here has to have a smart card to go to the doctor. The doc puts it in a reader, and the patient's history, medication, etc., all show up on the screen. The bill goes directly to the government insurance office and is paid automatically. So Taiwan has the lowest administrative costs in the world, less than 2%. They also use that smart card to track patterns of use.
If a patient goes to see a doctor or hospital over 20 times a month or 50 times in a 3-month period, then the IT picks that person out and then gets a visit from the government, the Bureau of National Health Insurance, and they have a little chat. And this works very well.
That may be too much like Big Brother for people in the U.S., but surveys show that Taiwanese are highly satisfied with their health care.
How many people in Taiwan every year go bankrupt because of medical bills?
None.
So the patients are safe from bankruptcy, but the system itself is under strain.
How much of the Taiwan's GDP are you spending on health care now?
We spend some 6.23%.
And do you know the number in America?
Yes,
what percent?
It's about 15%.
16%, that's right.
So the U.S. spends too much on health care and doesn't even cover everybody. But the Taiwanese just don't bring in enough money to pay for all the services they offer.
So actually, as we speak, the government is borrowing from banks to pay what there isn't enough to pay the providers.
Taiwan's politicians are reluctant to increase premiums. They're afraid the voters will punish them for it. So that's the problem here, and frankly, the solution is fairly obvious. Increase the spending a little to maybe 8% of GDP. And of course, if Taiwan did that, it would still be spending less than half of what we're paying in the USA. For NPR News, I'm T.R. Reid.
Today in Washington, a new pro-Israel lobby and political action committee is launched with the aim of changing the dialogue in Washington to encourage more diplomacy on the Arab-Israeli question and on Iran. NPR's Michelle Kellerman has more.
K Street is a well-known street in Washington, a base for many lobbying groups. There is no J Street until now.
J Street is a non-existent street in Washington, so we look at J Street as filling a gap in the political map in Washington, D.C.
That's Jeremy Ben-Ami, a former Clinton administration official who's launching the political action committee J Street today. The idea is to back congressional candidates who will advocate for a negotiated solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. J Street aims to create an online movement, much like MoveOn.org.
For too long, a small number of large donors from the right wing of the American Jewish community have actually hijacked the debate and have actually taken control of what it means to be pro-Israel. And we think we can reclaim that with an online movement where you bring large numbers of small donors together to give voice to their political views in a way that hasn't been possible before.
Is this what it means to be pro-Israel?
If America does not stop pressuring Israel to give up land, I believe that God will bring this nation into judgment.
The promotional video on YouTube features John Hagee of Christians United for Israel and some well-known neoconservatives who Ben-Ami says have also hijacked the pro-Israel cause. He goes out of his way not to portray J Street as an alternative to AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. But MJ Rosenberg of the Israel Policy Forum, a pro-peace think tank here, sees J Street as exactly that.
If there was no AIPAC that was mobilizing support for the status quo, there'd be no need for any of these organizations.
Rosenberg says a startup group could be influential if it's able to put real money behind its causes. And he gave one example, pointing out how AIPAC members accused Congresswoman Betty McCollum of supporting terrorists after she spoke out in favor of continued humanitarian aid for the Palestinians in the wake of Hamas's election victory.
It could have caused her problems. In the end, it didn't. She didn't back down, and she was reelected. But it would be a very good thing to be able to say to her, Congressman McCollum, if there's any campaign donations that you lose because of this position, you can gain on the other side from Jews who care about Israel but think that the best thing you can do for Israel is to be for peace.
An AIPAC official wouldn't go on record for this story but said that his organization does support Middle East peace talks and, unlike J Street, is not a political action committee, so it doesn't make sense to compare the two. Former U.S. negotiator Dennis Ross, now with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, says as a startup, J Street will have a lot of work to do to gain credibility.
Any group that would like to be affected the way AIPAC is would have to, in some ways, reflect the kind of AIPAC model, I suspect, meaning that first, it's nonpartisan. Second, it's also nonpartisan within Israel and is able to bring Israelis from across the political spectrum here.
20 former Israeli politicians signed a letter to support J Street, saying being pro-Israel does not require rigid agreement with every policy pursued by the U.S. and Israeli governments. And Jeremy Ben-Ami says J Street will back Democrats and Republicans this fall, focusing on a handful of congressional races. He says the goal is not to offer policy advice, but to let American politicians know they shouldn't fear debate over controversial issues, such as what to do about Hamas.
What we're going to do is affect the political dynamics and to make it possible to have at least a discussion here in the United States about whether or not somebody should be speaking to Hamas. That's really not on the table at the moment.
Dennis Ross said if he were advising J Street, he would stay away from that discussion for now and pick issues carefully. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. The University of California hopes a court will stop an escalating war with animal rights activists. Some faculty members experiment on animals, so animal rights groups have targeted the faculty. And lawyers for the university want a permanent court order to stop the activists before somebody gets hurt. NPR's Carrie Kahn reports.
On a quiet weekend afternoon in a tree-lined neighborhood near the University of California Berkeley campus,
Five young men and women, some wearing ski masks, stand in front of a house and start screaming.
You must understand!
Their blood is on your hands!
The protesters all look to be in their 20s and are targeting the home of a UC Berkeley researcher. A campus spokesman confirms that the faculty member uses cats in his research at the School of Optometry. That's enough to make him a regular target of profanity-laced chants from animal rights activists. Similar protests have occurred at the homes of UC researchers in Santa Cruz and in Los Angeles. And along with the chants, there have been threats.
There's a bomb out in the car. Don't go out and start your car.
That voicemail was left on the phone of a researcher at UCLA's Center for HIV Prevention. There was no bomb, but incendiary devices were found at the home of a UCLA behavioral scientist and under the car of a campus ophthalmologist. Both used primates in their lab work. Another faculty member's home was flooded with a garden hose. The school confirms that she uses primates for a tobacco addiction study. So far, authorities have no suspects.
We were deep asleep because it must have been 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, and then we had heard this enormous bang on the front door.
UC Vice Chancellor Roberto Pache and his wife were visited by demonstrators in the middle of the night.
Then somebody shouting, saying, "You will never sleep in peace again."
By the time the police came, the demonstrators were gone. But the protests continued and escalated to include other faculty. That prompted the UC Regents to get a restraining order against five animal rights protesters who frequently picket researchers' homes. Pache says activists were also ordered to shut down two websites that publish UC faculty names and home addresses.
We are very cognizant that we don't want to prevent people from having opposing views, but we do want to prevent people from having behavior that is really not acceptable.
But one of the targets of that injunction says the university is going after the wrong people. Lindy Green pushes open the kitchen door of her small apartment in L.A.'s San Fernando Valley. It's a mini animal rescue center. She has rabbit cages on her kitchen table and cats at her feet.
This is Haley. Yes, honey.
The 61-year-old Green is one of the named defendants in UCLA's restraining order. She says she joined the animal rights movement 20 years ago, when she had more teeth and fewer wrinkles. Green says she and her fellow animal lovers don't do anything illegal.
We're above-ground activists, and we simply get out and picket. We speak about what we consider to be grievous animal abuse, fraudulent science.
In court documents, victims claim Green has screamed threats at them and referred to the firebombings. She's already been arrested once for defying the restraining order. UC Regents lawyer John Houston says the school has to use aggressive legal tactics to protect its employees.
These defendants may not have lit the fuse on those Molotov cocktails, but when they are citing those and telling these faculty members they're going to be back to burn their houses down, they are willingly engaging in a campaign of illegal harassment and intimidation that is not tolerated under American law and is not protected as speech.
Houston says a new state law that proposes to stiffen penalties for violence against animal researchers will deter activists bent on committing illegal activities.
We'll be back! We'll be back!
The masked activists we saw at the home of the Berkeley researcher disagree. UC police say that same day windows were broken at the homes of other Berkeley scientists. Once again, police have suspicions, but no suspects in custody. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Los Angeles.
The West African harp called the kora is difficult to master. It has 21 strings, and the best players must have technique similar to a concert pianist. By many accounts, the greatest living kora player is Toumani Djibaté. He's from Mali. He's just released a solo album called The Mandé Variations. Banning Air has this review.
This is how it all started for Toumani Djibaté, just the man and his instrument. Djibaté debuted 20 years ago with the world's first solo kora CD, Kaira. Among the Mandé people of West Africa, the kora is for griots, traditional praise historians whose ancestors once enlightened the courts of Mandé kings. Mandé music has always been first and foremost an art of narrative, of words. Djibaté's career has demonstrated that the kora can recount history all on its own. This is Djibouti reinterpreting a classic song in the Kora repertoire, Alalake, a piece he also recorded on that first solo album 20 years ago. Mande music puts a high premium on innovation and improvisation, so when Djibouti comes back to the song, it's not unlike a venerable jazz man revisiting and reinventing, say, a Cole Porter standard. Djibouti's return to a solo recording is a welcome surprise, for no two of his albums have ever reprieved the same format. He's done duos and trios and fronted a big Malian band, not to mention his collaborative forays into jazz, blues, and pop with everyone from Roswell Rudd and Taj Mahal to Bjork. Djibouti has certain fetish songs he likes to readapt in various settings, like the love song Jarabi. Here he is spinning it as flamenco with the Spanish group Ketama back in 1988. The same song on the new Mande Variations CD is slower, deeper, the most subtle of Djibouti's many renditions. In the hands of a master like Djibouti, the Kora belongs to an African classical art form, one that's been evolving and growing for hundreds of years. With this work, Djibouti defines the very state of that art.
Banning Air is senior editor of Afropop.org. The album is by Tumani Djibouti. It's called The Mande Variations. You can hear songs from that CD at npr.org/music.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.